Welcome to the Badlands. That overlooked place where philosophical thought runs into the political concerns of the day. Hello and welcome to the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. I'm Toby Napolitano, and with me this week, as usual, is a guy who I really only have, like, bat anecdotes about, Michael Hughes. Like, this is just a separate segment, the Michael Hughes ongoing bat saga.
I mean, I do other things, but it does seem to occupy a large part of my life now.
Now, I've heard that the latest development is that you've installed fishing nets? Is that the plan now?
We didn't install fishing nets. We bought fishing nets to catch them with.
Wait, like manually? Like you have to go around?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Oh my goodness. I thought you were like hanging them up somewhere so they would like not be able to like come down off the ceiling.
No.
Oh, yeah. This is much more hilarious. Can we get video of this or something?
The reason for the fishing net is I actually killed it with my old crutch from basketball injury days.
I see. So you want a non-lethal means of capture?
Oh, I don't care about its life.
Oh, it's just more effective.
Yeah, it's incredibly hard.
So you'll capture it with the net and then kill it with the crutch again.
Sure.
I see. All right, well, that was Michael's bat update. I'm going to have to like come up with separate music for this recurring segment. Anyways, so for the next couple of weeks, we're going to talk about, I guess, broadly and generally, going to discuss issues that have to do with the government's relationship to non-citizens of various sorts, and its obligations to those non-citizens, and perhaps the rights of non-citizens as well with respect to the government. So next week, we're going to talk about the right to count in the census and be politically represented if you're a non-citizen, even though you can't vote, which is kind of interesting. And then the following week, we're going to ask the seemingly crazy question, but perhaps not so crazy, should non-residents, people who live outside of the United States, who have no legal connection to the United States, be allowed to vote or participate in the American democratic process? But this week, we wanted to focus on a different issue, and it was something that caught your attention, Michael, when you were foolishly listening to the news, I think.
Well, I think I was foolishly listening to the Democratic debates, presidential debates. I think the topic that I wanted to talk about this week fits fairly well into the way that you framed the next three episodes. One way to think about the issue that I think we should talk about is the obligations of states to contribute to the security of non-citizens, right? And we often think of the responsibility of the state as, or one of the critical responsibilities of a state is providing security for its citizens. But I think you can easily sort of get to questions about the obligations to provide security for non-citizens as well. The way that I entered into starting to think about this was while watching the presidential debates. And I don't remember at this point which candidate said this, but one of the candidates said something along the lines of, well, look, immigration is an area where there's actually a lot of agreement amongst everybody on stage. We all agree that we should have, you know, strong deportation policies for individuals who've been convicted of violent crimes. That's obvious. And it was that's obvious that got up my philosophical hackles. And I went,
exactly.
Really?
So this is where we have to perform our function as gadflies when someone says, well, at least we can all agree to this. We're like, I don't actually know about that.
Right. And so the moment that was said, I went and I Googled other candidates' positions and found that, there does seem to be a significant amount of agreement amongst the Democratic presidential candidates on that point. The vast majority of them are in favor of policies that would mean the prioritization of deporting or detaining individuals who are criminals or have a felony convictions or are deemed to be national security threats or committed violent crimes, something along those lines.
And this is something that goes back to the Obama administration, right?
I mean, yeah, so the Obama administration obviously had record deportations in the early years of Obama's presidency, but around 2014, there was a change in the deportation policy. And essentially what the Obama administration said was, we're going to prioritize the deportation of violent criminals. And I think that's where the majority of the Democratic presidential candidates still are on the issue.
Perhaps all of them, actually. All right, so it's interesting because, all right, so the vast majority of the debates surrounding immigration is sort of in reaction to what the Trump administration has done and the rhetoric that's associated with the Trump administration, which is obviously awful, right? We're talking about separation of families at the borders, the detention of children, separating them from their parents, really, truly awful things. So in some ways, it's been very easy for Democratic candidates because they can just oppose that obviously, those obviously terrible things without getting too specific. But of course, they don't want to be accused of promoting completely open borders, right, for moderate voters or perhaps some conservative voters who might be tempted to vote Democrat. They don't want to say like, oh, yeah, you know, completely wide open borders. So they want to say, look, we care about security too. And so one thing we could all agree on is that violent criminals should be deported. That sounds, I mean, probably to someone who hasn't thought about it, that sounds highly reasonable and justified. So why, without getting too far in the details, why should that not be so obvious?
So, I mean, there are, obviously we're going to consider a bunch of arguments for why that might not be so obvious. But the one that immediately came to mind when I started to sort of think more about this and read more about this was the observation that a number of economists have made and various studies that have been done on the relationship between our deportation of violent criminals and the impact that has on the nations of origin of those criminals. That is, the places that we are sending the people that we identify as violent criminals back to. And there are a number of studies that have been done that link those deportation policies to increases in the homicide rates of those countries. In particular, countries like El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, who have received a fairly high percentage of the violent criminals that we've deported in the last 20 or 30 years, have seen considerable upticks in the homicide rates in those countries and have had sort of destabilization of their economy occur as at least partially a result of these deportation patterns. And the studies sort of show that there is a pretty strong correlation between the number of violent criminals that we deport to those countries and the homicide rates in those countries. And so the obvious thing was, or the big question this raises to me was, okay, so there's a sense in which what we're doing is essentially exporting these security risks and harms to these foreign countries. Why is it obvious that the burden ultimately should fall on their shoulders to deal with these security risks? Why is it morally acceptable for us to punt on those responsibilities?
Okay, so the simple concern is that like this is not a kind of benign practice. If we deport violent criminals back to these countries, it seems like it's a very, very harmful thing to do for those communities. So it's something we should at least think about in more detail.
Right, and I think the other sort of side of this that we should at least flag, though, to my thinking, isn't the more important sort of thing to consider morally speaking, is the fact that the studies show that there, through this destabilization of the communities that we are sending these violent criminals back to, we are actually creating the conditions where we have more people fleeing violence from those communities and ultimately trying to then migrate to the United States, right? And this puts significant pressure on our efforts to actually secure the border, so that even if you come to this from a fairly sort of conservative place and you think that the United States really should only have a kind of us first policy or view of things, I think you still have to at least consider the possibility that these particular policies are self-undermining because they make all of the other security challenges that we have so much harder to deal with.
And it also separately puts pressure on the move to be strict with respect to receiving refugees, because if this is right, it turns out a lot of the people who show up, who enter into the United States fleeing violence, are actually in part doing that because of this deportation practice. But we'll talk more about that in the history later on.
So I think what I would like for us to consider throughout this episode is we should ask the question whether or not, morally speaking, it's justifiable for us to have the deportation policies that the Democratic Party is largely in favor of, namely the deportation of individuals who are identified as having violent criminal histories and who are therefore likely to commit acts of violence in the future. Now, I think we need to sort of make sure that we're clear what we're not entertaining in this episode, right? Because I think it's very easy, given the current rhetoric around criminals and immigration and the irresponsible way that the Trump administration talks, you might think that we're in some way entertaining or implying that that immigrants in general are more likely to be criminals than anyone else. And we'll post some studies on the site that demonstrate pretty clearly that that's not at all true. And in fact, most of the studies that we've looked at show that if anything, immigrants are less likely to be violent criminals than native-born Americans are. So that's not what we're entertaining here. Rather, what we are considering is the specific subset of the immigrant population, which every population has a subset of, those individuals who do have violent criminal histories. And in particular, we don't have to restrict ourselves to this, but I think this is the example that is most relevant to the research, the economic research. It's individuals who are associated with Latin American gangs and gang violence are the individuals who we deport at reasonably high numbers that then go on to terrorize their nations of origin. Right. And so it's really a very specific subpopulation that I think it's worth, that I'd like to have us focus on.
It raises these interesting questions that don't come up for the other parts of the population. Right. And it does seem like, look, if there's a case for deportation, it's probably with this group. Now, we don't know that the case is there, but it seems like it's probably the best bet for arguing that some group should be deported, or at least a candidate. Yeah. And I think the link to violent gangs is important for a couple of reasons, because in a lot of the discussions, what's going to matter, or implicitly what will matter, is the likelihood that another violent crime is committed. Now, probably not all violent crimes,
not all violent offenders are going to have the same recidivism rates.
Right.
And there are studies, we can link to studies that show that gang membership is an indicator of a higher recidivism rate, or is linked to higher recidivism than just having committed a violent crime in the past.
And it's particularly important in this case if they're going back to El Salvador or Guatemala, where the gangs they're a part of have really kind of incredible amounts of power, and it sort of plausibly could amplify the likelihood and their ability to commit more violent acts, which won't be true of other violent criminals.
Right.
I think that is an important feature to keep in mind. All right. So now let's consider what are some potential justifications for the deportation of violent criminals. I think a good place to start, and an argument that a lot of people have in mind, is just, look, if there's any legitimate function of the government, it's to protect the security of its constituents, its citizens, however the group you want to characterize, or however you want to characterize the group that it's meant to protect. Or even people who have a very minimalist view of the government agree that this is a legitimate function. Violent criminals, it would seem like, and people who are likely to commit more violent crimes, seem like an obvious kind of threat to the safety of Americans. So the U.S. has the right to deport these people. I wanted to just address this argument first, because I think it's kind of missing the point of the discussion, What the argument would establish, if anything, is that the U.S. has a right to deport certain people. But our question really is whether the government should deport them, whether it's morally permissible for the government to exercise that right, supposing it has it. Right? And to say that you have a right to do something is not to say, it's not the same thing as saying it's morally permissible to do it. So for instance, if you are massively wealthy and have a huge fortune, you might have the right to keep that fortune, but it's not morally permissible for you to hoard it when people around you are starving. Right? So the question about rights just really isn't the one we're interested in here. So we could grant it and still ask this question, but is it okay to exercise this right?
Right. And I think it's worth noting that there often in the conservative literature on the question of the rights of immigrants, there is a sort of flip side view that is regularly trotted out as an argument for why it should be acceptable to deport any criminal immigrant. The way that it's often talked about, it's like the way we talk to young people about their driver's license, right? That it's a privilege, not a right, to drive. And the way that it's often talked, like, it's a privilege, not a right, to be here, right? And a fairly common conservative view towards immigrants seems to be something along the lines of, immigrants are allowed to move here as a matter of privilege, not as a matter of right. And to even gain a kind of conditional right, they have to agree to abide by our laws. And if they fail to do so, then they've in some sense undermined that or violated that agreement, right? And thereby undercut whatever claim they have to stay here. Again, I'm not defending this. This is just a fairly common conservative way of framing the issue. But I think even if you were to grant this argument all the way down and say, okay, so maybe they have in some sense undercut the right that they have to be here. Nevertheless, it doesn't follow that just because they don't have a right to be here, what morally we should do is prevent them from being here, right? Or to deport them. Again, the basic issue here is it's not really a question of what we have a right to do or they have a right to claim upon us, but rather what we as a society ought to do. And even if you grant that kind of conservative position that they don't have a claim to be here or a right to be here, there's still the open question of whether or not we should let them be here nevertheless.
Someone who comes to mind here is Christopher Vellman. I think it's pronounced Vellman, who actually is someone we considered in the earlier episodes when we were talking about immigration. And if you're interested in the question of the right to exclude or the rights of immigrants to move freely, you should check out those earlier episodes. But his position, right, he defends the position that, yes, the state does have the right to exclude people because people in democracies have a right to association, right? They have a right to choose who can be a part of their group and who isn't a part of their group. But even he has one of these positions where it's like, yeah, I think the state has the right to exclude people, but we really should let in many more people. So he's also making this distinction between what we have the right to do and what morally we ought to do, just as another example of this. Okay, so the question about rights is beside the point. It really doesn't help us here. So where do we go if we want to ask, well, morally speaking, should we deport or not?
Well, maybe one thing we should note is, there might be a qualification we want to make, which is to say rights might be important here, right? If you actually think that you can argue for a right to be here, right, on behalf of immigrants, right? If you reject the Vellman line that the United States has a right to exclude due to the right to free association that members of a democracy have, right? So there are views that where rights would be relevant, but we think for the sake of this conversation, we can grant the sort of conservative position, and still all of the important ethical questions are still on the table. And rather than try to adjudicate the debate in this episode by considering the rights-based arguments, we want to consider the other kinds of justifications that can be given for the practices that we have adopted.
So what are those other justifications? I mean, the first thing that comes to mind for me, right, so imagine someone is looking at the situation this way. Okay, we have people who pose a security threat to whoever they are around, right? Violent criminals were likely to commit further violent crimes. Well, either you expose the American people to that threat, or you expose a different country to that threat, the country where the person is, the criminal's originally from. From there, you might appeal to some kind of nationalism of a weaker or stronger sort, which just says something like, well, when it comes to what U.S. elected officials ought to do, their obligations are to Americans first and foremost, right? Those are the people for whom they are meant to protect first. So if you have to choose between protecting Americans and non-Americans, plausibly, you might think if you accept that principle, you go with protecting the Americans. So therefore, you deport the violent criminals. And in fact, you might think not only is it permissible to do that, but that in fact, elected officials morally must do that because it's kind of their job to protect Americans first. So when we're considering defenses along these lines, there's really two things we need to discuss. First is the nationalistic assumption about prioritizing Americans defensible. And second, how does deportation affect the interests of Americans and non-Americans, respectively? So why don't we start first by looking at the nationalistic assumptions? And really, there's different versions of a kind of nationalistic principle, which comes in different strengths. And so what we need to ask then when we're distinguishing these principles is, what does it mean to promote American interests first and foremost, as people often say? In fact, I think Elizabeth Warren, in her foreign policy sort of statement, uses this phrase as well. Pretty much everyone does to some extent.
Yeah, I would say it's incredibly rare.
I'm saying like even Elizabeth Warren, right? Right. So why don't we start with a weak version, a weak nationalistic principle, which is something like this. If one has to choose between inflicting some harm, and really I'm talking about harms mostly and not really benefits, but we'll see if that matters. If one has to choose between inflicting some harm on Americans or inflicting a proportional harm on non-Americans, the U.S. government should avoid harming Americans. So in slogan form, that's just tie goes to the Americans, right? So it's nationalistic, right? Because it prioritizes Americans over non-Americans. But it's weak because it's a case where you have to choose between inflicting some harm on one group or the other. And in those particular cases, if it's proportional, you spare the Americans the harm.
So just taking the slogan form of this weak principle, tie goes to the Americans. I mean, this is one of those cases in philosophy that's like a Buridan's ass case, right? Where it's you have some decision to make and you have arbitrary, essentially, from a moral perspective, there is no good way to choose between which outcome you produce because in terms of you put things on the moral scales, they basically weigh the same, right? And so in some ways, this seems like a harmless principle, but at the same time, it also seems still like a completely arbitrary one. So I'm still left, even with a principle like this, going, okay, tie goes to the Americans. I mean, that's...
Why?
No better, that's no worse than tie goes to the foreigners, but it's not any more defensible.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question as to whether any of these can be defended. I think a couple of them, the stronger ones, we could just throw right out, and we will do that. But it would be an interesting project to try to defend even the weak version, because from the standpoint of moral theory, nationality doesn't matter at all, right? So like if you're a utilitarian, it's levels of well-being or utility, right? And that obviously isn't dependent on what your nationality is. Now maybe there's an interesting angle with respect to what civic obligations representatives have to their constituents, but at minimum, those seem like they're highly defeasible and they can be overridden by other considerations. And I think maybe, so let's consider maybe a slightly stronger version of a nationalistic principle, which we can call the moderate version, which would be something like this. If one has to choose between inflicting a significant harm on Americans or inflicting a greater harm on non-Americans, the U.S. government should avoid harming Americans. So here, they're not proportional harms. We have a case where you either have to, either Americans make a significant sacrifice or someone else makes a greater sacrifice. And this principle says avoid forcing Americans to make big sacrifices. this one would obviously conflict with like a basic utilitarianism, because that one would just say, you know, utilitarianism would just say minimize the suffering. So you should always opt to cause people to take smaller sacrifices if possible.
I mean, I think that I guess the one thing I would say is it's as you so the first argument seems hard to defend in virtue of being arbitrary. This one seems harder to defend in virtue of conflicting with egalitarianism in terms of how you look at the moral value of individuals, and that it conflicts with kind of utilitarianism.
As we go up in strength, these get harder to defend because they all suffer from the arbitrariness that the weak one suffers from, but then they also have these more troubling consequences. So let's get a little bit stronger. How about the strong version? The U.S. government should avoid inflicting any harm on Americans, no matter the cost to non-Americans. So this is a sort of complete no harm principle to Americans if it can be avoided. If you can place burdens on non-Americans, you should always do that no matter what they are. All right, this one's starting to sound a little crazy. And then finally, we have what I'm just going to call the insane version, which in many cases is closer to actual policy. The U.S. should promote the interests, avoiding harms and bestowing benefits on Americans, no matter the cost to non-Americans. So this isn't just not harming Americans, it's just you should just benefit Americans as much as you can, no matter how much suffering it causes for non-Americans. Okay, so I think for the purposes of our discussion, certainly the strong version and the insane version would certainly seem to justify, at least on the surface, the deportation of violent criminals. Why? Because exposing Americans to some threat, we'll count that as a harm, right? It's a kind of a sacrifice Americans have to make that's non-trivial. And so those versions would say that, yes, the government's justified in removing that threat to Americans. But we should probably just throw out the strong and insane versions because they have really crazy consequences.
They're both, I mean, they really both should be. It should be insane version one and insane version two if we're naming them appropriately.
That seems right. Right. Like, so just to take the strong version, right? So this is the government can't harm any Americans, no matter the cost to non-Americans. That means if it has a choice between, like, you know, slapping Jim in the face, Jim being some American, and causing the death of a million innocent non-Americans, you would avoid slapping Jim in the face because that would harm him, and the government can't do that. Now, of course, you'd have to build in that none of the Americans know or care about these other million people, and then, you know, the examples get complicated, but, you know, we could dream up a scenario where it would have a really awful consequence like that, and doubly so for the insane version. So I don't think we should even bother entertaining justifications that appeal to those principles here. So then the question will be, can we justify deportation on the basis of the weak or moderate versions of these nationalistic principles? Again, keeping in mind that they are deeply morally questionable.
I mean, it's pretty, the other reason to reject both the insane version one and insane version two of these principles is I think it's pretty clear that the vast majority of Americans explicitly reject those principles. In particular, it's pretty straightforward to come up with examples where Americans are in favor of, or people are in favor of Americans making sacrifices on behalf of non-Americans. So a classic example is World War II, where Americans, you know, most Americans feel as though it was a morally good thing that the U.S. joined the war effort, despite the fact that it came at significant cost in terms of the number of American lives lost. And the primary good that most Americans see coming out of our involvement in World War II is the prevention of atrocities committed against non-U.S. citizens, right? And this kind of, if Americans think that that is something that morally the U.S. government should do, then clearly you don't accept either of the very strong versions of the sort of nationalist principle.
And actually, I think it calls into question how much people accept even the weak and moderate versions, because the case you describe is one where the United States is making a significant sacrifice. Many Americans will die. in order to prevent harms befalling non-Americans. So that actually sounds like it's interesting, because I think if you presented people with these, with the weak and moderate principles, and asked them whether they accept them, I think a lot of the times they would say yes. But it also does seem like there are these exception cases where they do think that the U.S. should make sacrifices in order to promote the interests of non-Americans.
It does seem, this does strike me as a kind of, there is this kind of inconsistency with the way in which people evaluate American military intervention, right? Where often we justify military interventions along the lines of it being for this, you know, for the sake of producing some moral good for non-citizens. And obviously that comes at a significant sacrifice to Americans. And yet we are not willing to, or as inclined, a lot of people are not as inclined to make the analogous judgment in the case of like these deportation cases. Now it could be, I mean, there's some obvious questions you have to ask about why there is this difference in judgment, right? It could, an obvious possibility is that people simply don't even entertain the implications of deportation for the nations of origin. But nevertheless, one would hope that it would be pretty straightforward to point this out. And then, but I wouldn't expect that you'd actually end up getting consistent judgments one way or the other.
So keeping these nationalistic principles sort of in mind in the background, we now have to talk about, okay, so how does the deportation of violent criminals in these cases affect the interests of Americans and non-Americans? Now, the way we presented it, we said, well, look, there's a serious harm to, but it might look like, you know, you could get away with just appealing to the weak principle. Either you have to expose Americans to a security threat, or you have to expose non-Americans to a security threat. And so perhaps officials should deport violent criminals to protect Americans from the security threat. The problem is the threats to security in this case are massively asymmetrical.
Right. So the security threats that the individuals we are deporting pose to the American population seems like it's very different from the threat that it poses to the Latin American populations in most cases. So the studies that I mentioned earlier, one of the things that they highlight is the extent to which the homicide rate dramatically goes up as our deportation of violent criminals to those nations of origin increase. Right? I don't think anybody expects that if we were to cease deportation, that we would see a similar spike in the homicide rates here in the U.S. So there alone, just if you're looking at sort of the worst kinds of things that can happen as a result of these practices, you know, high-level violent assaults and homicides, I think the expectation is you're going to see a much higher increase in these states that we're deporting to than in the United States. And of course, that makes a lot of sense for a few reasons. One is just, well, we have a much more robust security infrastructure in place, right? We mass incarcerate, right? So we
it's one of the things we're good at.
we have the infrastructure to detain these individuals and to at least isolate the general American population from these individuals if we were to keep them here, which is going to be a challenge for economically depressed parts of the world that don't have that same infrastructure. And in part, and of course, it's kind of a vicious cycle, according to the research, because part of the reason that there's economic instability in those areas is the fact that the gangs that these individuals belong to extort the businesses and depress the economy and make it very difficult for people to actually build up that kind of stable infrastructure and have a stable government and things like that. I don't remember which documentary I saw this in, or if this was a podcast episode, but one example that sort of comes to mind as a vivid depiction of what it's like to live in a country that is where people are regularly subjected to this kind of violence is there was some example of individuals who were like setting up a basic like taxi cab busing kind of business. And the problem is they were so regularly extorted by the local gangs that they couldn't really afford to run their business. And then the threats of violence that they were subject to if they failed to pay the gang members the fees that they basically were required to pay for protection meant that these people weren't even free to sort of go about and live their life at all. So many of them sort of became shut-ins as a defense mechanism or a way of protecting themselves against the kind of threats that that gang violence subjects them to. And obviously in the United States, there are parts of the country where, you know, gangs are terrorized populations. So I don't want to imply that it doesn't exist at all here, but to the extent that it exists in those places seems to me to be significantly at higher levels than here.
So one thing the researchers point out is that the rates of violent crime and homicide in the countries we're talking about, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, are some of the highest in the world and rival what you see in war zones, right? I mean, and this partly explains why so many people are fleeing the areas to seek refuge. And then one of the other numbers I think I remember from one of the articles was that, I think it was in Honduras, a full 33%, one-third of the homicide rate could be sort of directly linked to violent criminals who were deported back into the area. So that's a massive, substantial effect on the homicide rate.
Right.
Which obviously you would not you don't expect similar kinds of effects if the violent criminals remain in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, in part because we can't pretend like the options here are to simply set the violent criminals loose in some foreign nation or set them loose here, right? There are other options. There's options to detain, to incarcerate, to try to rehabilitate here that do not exist in those other states.
Right, and in fact, if our choices are deporting or not, that would suggest that we're in a position to deport, which suggests that the U.S. government has custody of these individuals, or at least can gain custody of the criminal very easily. So surely, yeah, those aren't the options. So regardless of what you think of those options, you know, maybe you think detention is inhumane and unjustified, and often it is, likewise for incarceration, since those are options, at least with respect to the security threats that we're talking about to the innocent populations, there's a major asymmetry here. So that would suggest that the weak nationalistic principle, which says that, well, look, if there's proportional harms and you have to choose one side or the other inflicted on non-Americans, that's not the case here, right? So if you're going to try to justify the deportation of violent criminals on grounds of threats to security, you need a stronger kind of nationalism, which says that Americans should not have to make any significant sacrifices. Okay, but then the question is, do Americans make significant sacrifices by not deporting? I mean, what are the costs? What are the costs that we're talking about here?
So there's two different ways of thinking about the sacrifices that we have to make, right? Because there's a sense in which maybe no matter what, we're actually making significant sacrifices. We can come back to that particular sort of concern in a little bit. I mean, the first question is to ask is like, what are the direct significant sacrifices that we have to make if we don't deport these individuals, right? And it seems like there are a couple of obvious ones that come to mind. I think there's one that we'll flag that I do think people are likely to not give as much attention and weight as they should. So the obvious one that I think everybody would immediately, sort of the typical American would appeal to,
taxes. Are the financial it's gonna be taxes. Costs, yep.
of incarcerating these individuals. And, you know, one of the key things to point out is while we have mass incarceration, which obviously is hugely expensive and something we shouldn't probably do, the evidence is that, you know, the vast majority of immigrants are not actually these, you know, that we incarcerate are these violent criminals. So we're not necessarily in considering this question, we're not actually considering mass incarceration. We're talking about incarcerating a very specific subpopulation of violent criminals, namely those individuals who have documented connections to well-known violent gangs like MS-13, right? And that's while there will be some financial costs incurred, we're not talking about the massive numbers that, or at least, I mean, it depends. I don't have the number of MS-13 gang members that we incarcerate in front of me or deport, but I don't know that it's anywhere rivaling what we already incarcerate.
I doubt it. are there even, I don't think there are enough people in the gangs to come even close.
Right.
Because of the numbers we're talking about here. Yeah, and we should just say, we'll come back around to the question of of incarceration. I mean, we're not going to talk about it in detail in this episode, obviously. At some point we should. But the question of, if those are the options, is that okay in this context? But we'll come back to it.
The next two that I'm going to mention, I do actually think are more challenging, sort of more legitimate concerns to raise. So the obvious one to me is the actual physical safety of American prisoners, right? If we are going to not deport these individuals and we're going to detain them and incarcerate them, I think we as a society have an obligation to ensure that we can actually keep the population that we're incarcerating, as well as the other members of the prison population who don't belong to these sorts of gangs, secure. And if we can't do that, I think that does make for a moral problem. And I think it's something that often in these conversations is not considered, because the way it's often framed, it's like, well, we have an obligation to promote the security of innocent non-criminal Americans, and we have an obligation to promote the security of innocent non-US citizens, but who cares about the guilty, right? In some sense, they've forfeited their rights. This is an attitude that you regularly encounter.
There's a widespread attitude that criminals basically don't matter.
Right. And I think that's just fundamentally wrong. And I think it's easy to have this conversation without at least considering the implications for the prison population itself. I mean, one thing that anybody who's ever watched any prison documentary ever knows, gang violence within our prisons is an incredibly serious problem. And it's something that needs to be taken super seriously and something we should try to mitigate. So if there is one of the significant costs that I do think Americans would end up having to pay is, until we have actually created the infrastructure to incarcerate securely, right, this is a particular moral harm that we may be exposing a population to that we're not justified in exposing them to.
Seems right.
So that is, I don't know that that's going to give us a argument against, or in favor of deportation. We should ask that question in a minute. The other concern in the same neighborhood is, so when we're thinking about the costs that Americans are going to have to pay, the way I set it up was, well, so we have this choice to detain, or we could just, set these individuals free. Now, in a lot of cases, the people that we're incarcerating may not have been convicted of crimes that warrant a life sentence, right? They probably, in a lot of cases, were picked up, they were associated with some violent gang, and we arrested them on some other thing like aggravated assault, robbery, those other kinds of violent crimes, but maybe not the sort that would actually warrant life sentences. There is the case that maybe we are just kind of delaying the sacrifices to American security if we don't deport here, because for probably a high percentage of the individuals, we're going to release them. And as the research that we can link to shows, there's very high recidivism rates for individuals who were associated with violent gangs who were arrested in the past.
Right. Okay. I mean, so all right. So while it's not as though our options are releasing the violent criminals into American cities freely, or deporting them back to their countries of origin, there still are going to be threats to physical security that come along with detaining or incarcerating, one, to the prison population in the U.S., and then also to the general population if and when the violent criminals are released. So, fair enough. So there are threats. Now, clearly the magnitude of the threats to security, clearly there's still a major asymmetry here, right? Clearly, while there are threats to physical security for Americans, it's not nearly to the degree that the non-Americans would face. And so here it just kind of seems like, right? So note that the moderate principle, as we stated, has a good deal of ambiguity in it, because it's a question of, well, what is a significant cost? What's a significant sacrifice? And, you know, we're obviously not going to be able to pin down a precise point at which it's significant, but what the principle would reveal or how you interpret it, it's just a question of how nationalistic you want to be. How far do you go? You know, at what point is the sacrifice too great? And if you think that's too great, the sacrifice that we just mentioned, then you're pretty strongly nationalistic. If you think it's not too great, then you're a bit less nationalistic.
I think, one way to think about the moderate principle is probably the way it's typically exercised is there's a kind of, we try to weigh the harms to the American population against the non-American population. And then the more nationalistic you are, the more you have a weighted bias in favor of the American population against the non-American population. And the question is, how much is that weighted bias in favor of the American population is the sort of moral principle that you tend to operate on? I think an interesting kind of standard for consistency in these sorts of cases is to go back to the kind of cases where we are, where Americans are willing to defend military intervention of the United States on behalf of non-U.S. citizens, right, to prevent some kind of harm to non-U.S. citizens. It seems to me that a lot of Americans are willing to accept that kind of defense of military interventionism, though maybe we don't have as much of a stomach for it these days since the Iraq War, but nevertheless, there's a kind of principled acceptance of it at some point when you're weighing the harms for non-American citizens against American citizens. And it seems like at least a reasonable standard of consistency that we might ask for is that, well, in the cases where you would be in favor of U.S. intervention to prevent harms to non-citizens, are the harms that you're weighing in the case of deportation sort of analogous? If they are, then you probably should have a kind of consistent judgment about when it's okay to ask for Americans to make some sacrifices of security on behalf of non-citizens. And it seems to me that if you recommend that kind of standard of consistency, that does push you in the direction of thinking that we ought not to deport these individuals that we're considering, given that the homicide rates, as you mentioned, are some of the highest in the world and rival regions of the world that are basically in a state of civil war. Given that the homicide rates are in that neighborhood, right? We're talking about the kind of sacrifices of non-U.S. citizens that are on par with the kinds of cases that we typically would, or a lot of Americans would typically then think it would be justified in military intervention on humanitarian grounds. And then when you consider the actual sacrifices of Americans in the case of deportation. So it's clear that whenever we're sending American soldiers abroad to engage in military intervention, they're risking their lives, and there's going to be some American soldier casualties, or at least that's a significant risk that we're incurring. And it seems to me that if we're willing to make that ask that sacrifice of American soldiers, then I don't see what the justification is to then say we wouldn't be willing to accept similar kinds of risks for the general population.
I mean, the cynical take is, the non-deportation of violent criminals doesn't require the purchase and production of lots of weaponry and military equipment. And so, but of course,
well, right.
We're operating on the level of stated principle, not cynical reality.
Right. And I do, the thing is, I think that's fair, right? And I think the obvious sort of reply is these are just principles of consistency for people who sincerely believe the principles and the justifications that they state.
Right.
That may end up being a tiny minority of people who claim to favor military intervention for those reasons. I do think that there are at least some conservative writers that who state acceptance of these kinds of principles that I at least believe them.
So I think we should move on to a complication that is just kind of lurking in the background here. And that is, it relates to the jurisdiction of the U.S. government to either detain or incarcerate a violent criminal from another country. For instance, in some cases, the violent criminal presumably won't have committed any crime in the U.S. Of course, they still pose a threat to people's safety if they are likely to commit more violent crimes. In that case, right, if our options are deportation and incarceration, does the U.S. have any grounds for incarcerating them? I mean, it seems like there's two different kinds of problems here. You might think that this is, first, you know, one concern is, are we in some ways violating the rights of the country of origin to execute their laws with regard to their citizens? And then the second concerns the rights of the violent criminal themselves, by confining them when, A, they had no input in the democratic process, so there's a question of legitimacy of the government to coerce these people. And second, you might be concerned, well, they don't really have a possibility of a fair trial in the United States, especially if we're talking about crimes they've committed elsewhere. So there's a kind of jurisdiction rights issue here, or a handful of them, actually.
Yeah, this gets complicated.
So maybe we should start with, I mean, I think we can just kind of explore various responses to this complication.
Right.
I think in the case of, you know, concerns that the U.S. government is sort of co-opting the job of the El Salvadorian government or the Guatemalan government, for instance, those concerns don't seem too problematic to me here, because given the statistics we just mentioned, it does seem like, and given the state of affairs that you mentioned, where the gangs are really incredibly powerful entities in these places, it's not clear that those countries have the infrastructure in place to actually exercise their authority and execute their laws anyways. So you might, I mean, maybe it would require like sort of consent from these governments, and you might expect that they'd be like, yeah, go ahead. we can't deal with them, so please. I don't know if that's the case.
Honestly, I think this is probably the easiest concern, because we have the option to negotiate agreements with those countries about how we will handle these cases. And my intuition is that if the countries of origin wanted to exercise their authority and to enforce their laws, that we then might have an obligation to respect those wishes. It depends in part on just how bad sort of the consequentialist scales are in terms of the harm.
Right. So that would get complicated, right? Because you'd think, okay, so then we extradite these criminals to their countries of origin. But suppose the governments of the countries of origin insist that they be the ones to try them and detain them, etc. But they can't.
Right.
They can't do this well, and the cost to their own citizens is great. Then you would be faced with a sort of difficult problem.
Right.
about what to do there. But I don't know. I don't know that this is what is the case or what the.
Well, there certainly are cases, yeah. like there are there certainly are historical cases, particularly of violent drug traffickers, like Pablo Escobar comes to mind. You know, where the U.S. has these sort of tensions with the state in terms of what they're going to do if they end up arresting those individuals, and it certainly I think is. If you ever watch the series Narcos, it's clear that there's a delicate dance that, yeah. The U.S. diplomats have to do in order to deal with these cases. I think, though, I think a lot of the time the United States is actually in position to just negotiate agreements that we can kind of agree on And we have at least some, we have an obligation to respect the state's rights to execute their own laws, at least up to a point. Now, there might be some, you know, there might be ceteris paribus conditions that are violated in cases where lots and lots of harms are, you know, resulting from respecting those rights. But in general, I think it's fair to at least try, right, to do so. But I don't know that that's actually as much of a problem as the other cases that you described.
So the rights of the violent criminal themselves, in particular, when they haven't committed a crime in the U.S.
Yeah, I think that's probably the hardest case, right? So there's just the basic procedural fairness that is we think is an absolutely critical part of our democratic society. And how do you respect that basic backbone to your democracy and at the same time not just either deport these individuals or allow them to sort of roam freely within your country? I think that's a genuinely tough case.
So here's an unpopular position, I would imagine. That would sound awful to lots of people, but doesn't seem completely crazy to me. So suppose I haven't committed a crime in the United States. You want to respect their rights to sort of move freely in the U.S. until they have, you know, there's warrant to detain them for whatever reason. It still seems like that asymmetry, like if your options are letting them go free in the U.S. until they commit a crime in the U.S., in deporting them, it still seems like that basic asymmetry is still there. So if you're not particularly nationalistic, you might say, well, if someone has to bear the burden of the presence of violent criminals, Americans can do it much better by virtue of the infrastructure in place. They should be the ones to do it. Like if you're sort of a pure utilitarian, but you wanted to, but of course, you wanted to respect their
yeah,
rights.
You're not a pure utilitarian.
Right, okay, fair enough. You wanted to, you know, you didn't want to incarcerate anyone who didn't have a trial or who didn't commit a crime in the U.S. or something like that. That does seem like a position that could be defensible. It would sound completely nuts to Americans.
No, I think that, but I think it's obvious. I mean, the obvious reply is, look, if human rights requires that you not incarcerate these individuals, and your options are either to unjustly incarcerate here or deport where they will not be incarcerated, so either way, you're not incarcerating them, then you have an obligation to choose whichever is going to minimize the harms that you think those individuals will inflict. And we know, just if you look at the recidivism studies, you know that if those individuals are in the U.S. And they commit crimes, the thing is that they'll be incarcerated later in the U.S. So the primary difference is in countries that don't have the law enforcement infrastructure in place to actually catch people who've committed violent crimes and incarcerate them, what happens is the population in countries without that institutional framework end up being terrorized by those individuals. Whereas here, you will have individual victims, but you won't have terrorization of the society in general, right? And they won't be able to act with impunity while they're committing those kind of crimes. And just on those grounds, it seems like the kinds of harms you're exposing people to is significantly worse in the case of deportation. I mean, this is one of those cases where if you have incredibly strong evidence that somebody is going to commit very serious harms, at some point your human rights concerns are outweighed, right? This is the classic ticking time bomb philosopher's experiment, which probably makes for bad social policy.
But this is, of course, the difficulty, right? Like we have statistics, you know, when we say, well, there's given what we know, there's such and so probability that this person will commit a violent crime in the future, then you have to ask at what point is that too high? And of course, then, you know, you're stripping this person of their rights to move freely before they've done anything because you perceive them as a risk. I mean, these are just very hard questions.
And you have to then be super concerned about the way in which our judicial system is racist And the way in which, if you allow for our institutions to actually make these kinds of decisions, you will end up with incredibly unjust and racist policies and execution of policies. So in the end, you might end up thinking the best option is simply for Americans to bear the security risk. And I think that might be the sort of morally justifiable position that happens to be incredibly unpopular and that you're not ever going to get anybody to sign up for.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that the questions about jurisdiction raise serious complications. It does still seem like they're not decisive in favor of deportation. It seems like there are responses one can give to that and say that, yes, unless you're like super nationalistic, deportation is still impermissible. Now, another reply that one can give to the defense of deportation, which says that, it's a threat to American security, is the one that you've kind of mentioned before. It's a threat to American interests, which is to argue that actually deportation is self-defeating to American interests because of the vicious cycle that is created by the deportation of violent criminals, causing massive numbers of people to flee their countries of origin to come to the United States, making it very difficult to police the border, for instance. So if that's one of your concerns, and certainly tends to be more of a concern for conservatives and centrists, though this is a difficult area, right? When we discussed immigration, it's really hard to know there isn't a clear leftist stance on immigration or on, the status of the border, because it's very, given the kind of barbarous nature of the extreme right-wing rhetoric around immigration, it's easy to just say, well, not that. I don't know what my position is, but not that. But in any case, right, for people who are concerned about the ability to maintain a border, and of course, there are, as we were talking about, real threats to security that go along with not being able to control the border, the practice of deportation exacerbates that problem to the extent that it is a problem.
The reason to bring that up is, so we just gave a bunch of arguments that likely aren't going to convince anybody except sort of people who are way out there on the left like ourselves, right? I think one, and this is a question I have for the authors who tend to, that I've read, who make an argument against the deportation of violent criminals along the lines that we've been discussing. They tend to then frame it in terms of American security interests and note exactly as you have that the major challenge is if you are creating unstable conditions in Latin America, which are leading to large numbers of people fleeing violence, it just becomes a strain on the system to be able to just do the administrative work needed to not even necessarily have good border security, but just do the kind of, basic border administration that we would want to have just to know how many people are in the country, what kind of resources.
Or to be able to allow people who want to and can enter legally to do so quickly.
Right.
And easily and conveniently.
And it just...
Which is not at all the case.
Right. And the more that you have people who are... The more that U.S. foreign policy is contributing to the destabilization of the areas where people are fleeing and then trying to come here to seek refuge, you're going to make it more and more difficult to do that basic administrative work and to then also do the kind of vetting that people think you need to do in order to have, border security and to deal with the... this subset of the population of individuals who, are engaged in, significant antisocial behavior, and who are creating significant harm. I mean, the fact of the matter is like the gang members that the MS-13 gangs, they do bad stuff, right? They traffic people. They, commit violence and extort people. And everybody on the left and the right can agree that we should do something to try to mitigate those harms. But the more that we are just taking this sort of zero tolerance deportation approach, the harder we're actually making it for ourselves to be able to do that work. And so I think while we might be able, we might fail to convince people through the arguments that we gave earlier, it does seem like this may be persuasive even to, it may be persuasive to everybody.
So something you said there, I think, leads us nicely to our the next thing we should consider, which is actually an argument against deportation, a sort of a positive argument against deportation, which says that actually the United States government and its policies are in a lot of ways responsible for the conditions that have led to the rise of these gangs, gang violence, and the horrible homicide rates and violent crime rates in the countries that we've been talking about. Therefore, the United States has a special obligation that other places and entities don't have, even if they are, if they could help. The U.S. has a special obligation to do something about this because it helped to create the problem in the first place. Therefore, at minimum, it shouldn't continue to deport the violent criminals, because not only does that not help to address the problem, it makes it worse. So you might think part of a strategy to remedy the, to address the terrible conditions that the U.S. has helped to create is to cease to deport violent criminals back to their countries of origin.
Right. So, I mean, in some ways, what we've been doing up to this point are has been to consider various sort of consequentialist sort of arguments for and against these deportation practices. And I mean, in some ways, what you pointed to is a kind of a not really a consequentialist argument, right? But a argument from a certain kind of social responsibility that one occurs when one has actually contributed to or committed harms or created harms for people, right? And the key thing to note is that the United States has played a pivotal role in the creation of these conditions, right? And the history, I mean, this is a super, obviously, an incredibly simplified version of the history, but the history that some of the papers will post references to cite, and sort of familiar stuff from anybody who've studied international relations, the United States, I know this is shocking, we funded sort of activity that led to some of the civil wars in Latin America. I know you're shocked that
I'm stunned. My mouth is just hanging open.
So, in
particular during the Cold War era, right, to oppose left-wing right. governments that were vying for power there.
And in particular, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala went through a period of mass immigration from those countries into the United States. And in particular, a lot of immigrants went to Southern California fleeing violence that was at least partially created by the U.S. funding leftist, anti-leftist organizations during the Cold War. This led to this, you know, these pockets of immigrants that were refugees in Southern California who then were exposed to the sort of gang culture and gang activity in that area. And there's significant evidence that it was actually that exposure to that gang culture and gang activity that then led to those, when those individuals were deported from Southern California back to Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, the actual creation of these gangs in those areas that then went on to terrorize the population, to extort the population, and to increase the overall homicide rate, right? So the U.S. in some ways had a direct historical role in the creation of the conditions that have then since led to these, you know, new migrations of individuals to the United States.
Right. So, okay. So the U.S. is implicated in two ways, which is interesting here. One, in the sort of promotion of civil wars, you're contributing to the general political and economic destabilization of the areas. That's important. But then the other bit is that the gangs like MS-13 that we're talking about actually originated in the U.S. and then were sort of
deported.
I don't want to say exported, yeah, but deported back to these countries. And then they were able to sort of gain a foothold in part because of the destabilization that was already that I just alluded to before. So it seems like the U.S. government is kind of doubly implicated in the creation of these horrible conditions that we're talking about.
Right. And then you can think, okay, I think if you go back to this sort of like, well, immigration, you go back to the earlier sort of conservative view that we
started with, that was just like, well, you know, it's a privilege to be here, so the U.S. has the freedom to do whatever it wants. That's an oversimplification of this situation. The U.S. actually has played an active role in the creation of these problems and has incurred obligations to mitigate and to provide redress for these problems that we helped contribute to, right? So it seems like the history is super relevant to assessing what the American population's obligations are to these non-U.S. citizens who ultimately are currently bearing most of the burden as far as the security problems that come with our current deportation practices.
Okay, so I mean, imagine someone who is in favor of deportation could hear this argument, and one response they could have is like, okay, I hear you. The U.S. government does have special obligations to do something to remedy the situation that it helped to create, right? But that's an obligation to just do something. That doesn't mean that you can't deport. So it might be, for instance, that the U.S. It is permissible for the U.S. to deport the violent criminals, but it also should be maybe giving lots of aid to these countries to help to stabilize the economy or something like that. And then, right, so the obligation is just to do something, and perhaps something significant to help change the situation. And they might say, you know, deporting or not isn't, that's not going to completely change the outcome in those countries. And, you know, maybe we cite one of the nationalistic principles earlier and say, well, yes, or perhaps this is a cost that's too significant for Americans to bear, and we can help in other ways.
So this is reminiscent of the discussion we had about refugees, right, and the obligations of states to accept more refugees. And effectively what we came, you know, the argument that we ended up considering as sort of most plausible was one in favor of a kind of disjunctive position, right, that we either have an obligation to provide considerable aid to mitigate the material deprivation of the individuals who are fleeing the situations that they were in, or else we have an obligation to accept those refugees. And this is a lot like that, right? This is, we basically have an obligation to either allow, continue to host these individuals that threaten the nations that we would deport them to, or we have an obligation to provide those nations with the resources they would need to build up the security infrastructure to be able to deal with those populations themselves. And that seems right to me that there's probably a kind of disjunctive obligation. It's all a question of, okay, which one, I think probably the biggest question is, well, which one of those is going to be effective, most effective, which are really achievable now, because these are problems that exist right now and we have to do something about it.
Yeah. So one concern, for instance, is that you can't just, like, we can't just force political stability in these countries, or even economic stability, especially, you know, in the cases we're talking about. What do you do to mitigate the power that the gangs have in particular countries? Military intervention? Right. I mean, I guess the concern would be just sort of contributing lots of money or even expertise. It's hard to see how it's going to effectively move the needle.
Right. I mean,
these kinds of problems.
But this is why I think it's partly a question of the effectiveness of that disjunctive strategy. And if your primary problem is that the individuals that you're sending to these countries get involved in gang activity that then extort individuals, well, businesses and the government, and force them to give up significant amounts of money through threats of violence, then just giving them more money and more resources by itself doesn't prevent the extortion from continuing.
So I mean, really what this suggests, I think, is not that the obligation is disjunctive, that we can do one or the other, but that it's conjunctive, because none of the things in isolation really do much. I mean, the non-deportation of violent criminals, we've given the research we've cited, actually would be significantly beneficial. That doesn't plausibly do enough to certainly make the, you know, the situations in these countries great, and it might not do enough to compensate for the U.S. government's role in the creation of those conditions. So plausibly, it's got to be a combination of things, I would think.
Yeah, I think that's true that it has to be probably any effective solution is going to be conjunctive. It's going to be doing a variety of things. I also think in general, so a lot of the sort of moral trade-offs that we've discussed where it looks like there is no sort of morally acceptable move for the U.S. to take, right? Like the current option of incarcerating individuals doesn't by itself, given the current conditions of incarceration, doesn't seem like a morally acceptable move to make, because we know that as our prisons are currently constructed and the way in which they work, we are not creating secure conditions for our existing prison populations or the people that we would be incarcerating.
Nor are we making plausible attempts at rehabilitation. Right. I mean, yeah, there's human rights concerns all over the place with respect to the prisons, which gets us to the objection we sort of mentioned before, and we should consider, like, how can you be in favor of more incarceration?
Right. Well, this is
right. Is that what you're saying?
This is again the thing is really the only way I think you can plausibly defend the position of being in favor of more incarceration is if you are in favor of a sort of that in conjunction with massive prison reform and general changes in our incarceration rates, that there has to be a massive criminal justice reform effort that is conjoined with the decision to incarcerate these particular individuals that we're focusing on before you land in an option that is defensible on human rights grounds.
Yeah. Now, it becomes tricky if you know, as we do, I would say, that, you know, in the next couple of years, that's not forthcoming. Right? Those massive reforms are not happening right now, and there's question about whether we should deport or not violent criminals right now. It seems like there's a couple of options here. One is to just say, yeah, there's no morally good option. None of our available options here are actually good. Some are worse than others. And what we're going to have to do is just take the least bad option. And that could be incarceration for violent criminals who are likely to commit more violent crimes. That's one possibility. The other one, it seems like, okay, so either it's about the safety and security of existing prisoners and the rights of freedom and other things of the violent criminal. The other option is don't incarcerate, leave them in the U.S. until they commit a crime in the U.S. But then you still have the basic incarceration problems. But yeah, it could just be that all the options suck, but some suck worse. I mean, isn't that all of sort of doing applied ethics in the real world? None of the available options are ever good. That's not quite true, but it often seems that way.
Yeah, I mean, the hard part for trying to reason through what decisions should be made policy-wise is trying to think through what actually has to be held fixed as you work through the options. I think that's what makes this particular problem especially difficult to weigh what the real worst options are.
All right, well, fuck. So, all right, so where did we end up here?
Confused.
The arguments in favor of deportation are tough. I think they're tough to make. They're tough to defend. But the resulting positions are not super great ones either.
But at the end of the day, what it the very least has to happen is that we have to stop treating it as obvious that we should just continue to go down.
Right. That's our role in our job here, just to say, look, it's not obvious.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've done our job. So if listeners, you thought we could all agree on this, you thought it was obvious. I don't know.
Probably still
hopefully
do.
Hopefully you don't know. Yeah. And I guess this will hopefully set the stage for the next couple of episodes when we move from talking about what?
Where we start going from the non-obvious to just different levels of insanity. From the average, the normal perspective.
Right. Yeah, that seems right. Right. So we'll move to talking about the rights of non-citizen residents and political representation, and then non-residents and their potential rights to political participation. we get really crazy. But as is often the case, the views that seem the most crazy, you're like, when you think about it, you're like, oh, shit, yeah, that might be right.
Yeah.
But we'll get
that's
there.
That's what philosophy
we'll
is.
that's literally, it's the enjoyable part of it, right? Being like, oh, shit, son of a gun. Yeah, that could be right. Yeah. that's when philosophy's fun. Anyways, Michael, thank you for this discussion.
Yeah, same.
It's been good. Good luck with the fishnets.
Thank you.
Fishing nets.
Yeah. Yeah.
Send us some pictures we can post on
You don't want
Twitter.
To see that.
fair enough. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can help it grow by subscribing and by giving it a good rating or a review. And don't forget to check out our website, badlandsphilosophy.com, where you can find a list of citations for every episode and access written content that we post there regularly. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that through our website, and you can also find us on Twitter at the Badlands Pod. Thanks again for listening.